It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon, I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. You know I'm a fiction fundi, I love fiction, but there is something special about real people's lives, real people's stories that make for compelling reading. And so today we are going to explore the world of autobiography, biography, and memoir. These are the stories about real life and messy human living. It's not a record of everything that happened, but a record of how things felt, what it meant to live that experience, what faded and what stayed. It's about heartbreak and love and family and humor and the contradictions that we all live with. A memoir doesn't say, this is what happened. It says, this is what happened to me, this is what I lived, and this is how I make meaning from it. A memoir or an autobiography also helps us to step into someone else's shoes, someone else's life, and in so doing, understand theirs, but also understand our own a lot better. It's a kind of emotional authenticity which is really needed in the world that we live in now, which often feels so curated and filtered and edited for effect. So today's show brings together an extraordinary cast of lives, a soldier, a vet, a world-famous author, a Holocaust survivor, and a little Jewish boy who gets lost and found on the streets of Cape Town. I'd love to bring you into the conversation too. Have you read a memoir that felt so honest and so familiar it was like you were reading your own story? Let me know on the WhatsApp line 061-895-1019. First, a word from our sponsors, and then we'll get into the books. Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics for Adults offers convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks. Whether you're having your regular wellness checks, such as blood pressure or cholesterol, Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics offers you a broad range of health screening services, including female's health screening with pap smears, family planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care. Find your nearest Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic inside a Dis-Chem pharmacy. Better health starts here.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and you're listening to Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. Today we're talking biography and memoir. And my first book introduced me to a world that I really know nothing about, but got to live vicariously through the pages. We often speak in terms of proverbial war stories, but this is the real deal. It's called Dog Tag Memories, The Misadventure of a South African Defence Force Conscript by John Gutcher. Dog Tag Memories is a raw, darkly humorous, believe it or not, memoir that follows John Gutcher's chaotic journey through South Africa's military machine. He was drafted into the Defence Force in 1977 as a carefree 17-year-old, and his tranquil schoolboy days are abruptly replaced by the brutal regimentation of army life. So what begins as naive indifference soon spirals into a struggle against authority, misfortune, and of course the absurdities of war. Throughout the laughable rules, the harsh punishment, the grinding boredom, fatal mishaps and clashes with enemy guerrillas, he endures with wit, irony, and a stubborn refusal to surrender his humanity. It's told with unflinching honesty and biting humor. It's a story, a human account of camaraderie, hardship, and resilience. Although it's not a genre I usually dip into, books about army, war, and combat remain perennially popular and in fact top all charts, but particularly in South Africa. So this book really does earn a place amongst them. The second book is rather a lot of fun. It's called Unleashed by Caitlin Venneker. Who would think that The Secret Life of a Vet would make for such entertaining reading? Unleashed is a hilarious, intensely honest memoir of Caitlin Venneker's journey from Onderstepoort, the only veterinary training institution in South Africa, into the heart of private practice with a few stops in the UK, in the Middle East, and of course home in South Africa. It's also a story about growing up, about juggling owners with high expectations and animals with big opinions, bluffing confidences, quirky colleagues, cows with anger issues, and midnight emergencies. It's also about navigating dating, using coffee as a crutch, and the general mayhem that happens behind the scenes in a vet. I want to read you some of it to give you a sense of the fun that she speaks about, both some of it quite moving, but a lot of it light and a delicious read. The book's called Unleashed, a vet's memoir of heartache, hairballs, and hope. And she starts with a kind of contextual information about Onderstepoort, which I actually didn't know much about. She says, the grimy corner of Pretoria North. And for most years, more than 1,000 students fight it out on main campus for the 100-odd places. And if you don't make the degree, you don't make it, then you're pretty much stranded like a boat without a mast, she says, clutching your sanity and smacking your compass until it points to genetics, zoology, or even botany. But if you do make it, there is fine print to read on the faculty's application website. And this is for real. Applicants should take note that a high level of mental resilience is required to thrive in this profession. Applicants with prior or existing mental health risks should consider this carefully and seek professional advice when considering a career as a veterinary professional. It's sound advice, she says. After all, as any South African vet will tell you, the only thing harder than getting into Onderstepoort is getting out. Her chapters all have hilarious, sometimes incomprehensible headings. And I'll just tell you one of the firsts is called Hemorrhage, Hydrosis, and Lacrimination. And for you and me, as just ordinary folk, that means blood, sweat, and tears. So we've had a little bit of fun with the army and the animals, but now for a heavyweight. It's Margaret Atwood's Book of Lives. How does one of the greatest storytellers of our time tell her own story? The long-awaited memoir from the author of The Handmaid's Tale and The Testaments is one of our most lauded and influential cultural figures. She's an icon, she's a legend. And she asked the question herself. She said, why would a writer pen a memoir? Surely, the books you write are a memoir, but she has. And she tells of how she was raised by ruggedly independent, scientifically minded parents, an entomologist father and a dietitian mother. And Atwood spent most of each year in the wild forests of northern Quebec. This childhood was unfettered and nomadic and sometimes very isolated. She says, it sounds forlorn, it was forlorn, and it got more forlorn. But it's also thrilling and beautiful. And from this very unconventional start, Atwood unfolds the story of her life, linking seminal moments to the books that have shaped our literary landscape. Along the way, we meet major political turning points. We meet poets, we meet bears, Hollywood actors, and larger-than-life characters straight from the pages of an Atwood novel. She is so witty to listen to. I encourage you to go online and listen to some clips with Margaret Atwood speaking. She's articulate and funny. An epic quip, she says, well, there are lots of boyfriends in this book, and someone does get murdered, but not by me. The thing is, memoirs are what you can remember. It's the stupid things, usually strange things, catastrophes, and weird people you have known. There's also a great story about the cover of the book It has Margaret Atwood in a gorgeous jacket with her finger in front of her mouth, like gesturing, shh. The collar kind of looks like a folio, and that's why it was chosen. And if any of you have ever done a photo shoot, you know how tedious and annoying it can be, particularly by the end. So at the end of this photo shoot, she started fooling around, as one does, and she gestured in a playful way, hear no evil, covering her ears, see no evil, covering her eyes, and speak no evil. And the speak no evil is what landed on the cover. So as we travel along the course of her life, more and more is revealed about her writing, her connection with real life and art, and the workings of one of our greatest imaginations. It is a brick of a book, but it does have drawings and images throughout, and it's available in audiobook too. Just I'll leave you one last sentence from Margaret herself. A word after a word after a word is power. After the break, we're going to be talking to author Eric Lieberman about his book, The Boy in the Barrel, which we've been working on for months and months, close on 18 months, and I look forward to that. That's after the break. We want to hear from you. Chai FM is updating our Voices of Chai, and we need your voice to do it. Send us a voice note, 30 seconds or less, and tell us why you're part of the Chai FM community. What keeps you listening? What does the station mean to you? Send your voice note to 061-895-1019. That's 061-895-1019. We can't wait to hear from you.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. Today, we are delving into memoir, biography, and autobiography. And my guest in studio today, which is an enormous treat, is Eric Lieberman, the author of a book called The Boy in the Barrel, based on the true story of a boy who lost his childhood and found himself. The book opens in Vilna, 1899, and an 8-year-old Izzy Lieberman leaves his snow-covered homeland with only his father. His family we're going to follow later, like so many of our families. They were escaping the pogroms, and they were bound for a new life at the edge of the world in Cape Town, South Africa. But amid the chaos of the port and as tensions rise in the days before the Anglo-Boer War, Izzy's father vanishes, and in the confusion, Izzy is left behind, forgotten, frightened, vervoerlen, thrown away. Alone on the harsh streets of Cape Town, he learns to survive amongst the city's homeless boys who become his only family. And years later, drawn north to the diamond diggings of Kimberley, he toils under the blazing African sun with them, unearthing both fortune and sorrow. The Boy in the Barrel is a sweeping historical journey from Eastern Europe to the raw, restless soul of Africa, a story of survival, of forgiveness, and the unbreakable bonds of family. And we are delighted to have the author and biographer of this unforgettable story in studio. Eric, a very warm welcome.
Thank you, Batya. Great to be on your show.
This little boy, Izzy, was not just a little boy to you. It was your grandfather.
Yes.
And it has been your mission over the last 18 months or more to capture his story in a book. What motivated you to do that?
Well, the inspiration for writing the book, it didn't arrive as a single moment of clarity, but rather as a quiet persistence, a story that refused to leave me as my father, uncles, and aunts, and so much more family that knew all about my grandfather, constantly told me jaw-dropping stories about their father, my grandfather. I knew him as a kid. He died when I was 6. And with all the family stories, there was something unsettling and unresolved, I felt, as though a voice had been silenced too soon, and it was still waiting to be heard. So over time, that feeling deepened into a sense of responsibility, and I wasn't just drawn to the story. I felt compelled to follow it, to understand it, and ultimately to tell it.
It's a heartwarming story. You should just know that it's a wonderful, wonderful story. But the beginning is heartbreaking. There's this little boy abandoned. He cannot speak the language. He knows nothing of the people. He knows nothing of the context in which he's been. And he is left alone on the streets of Cape Town and made to somehow make his way. And to survive the streets of Cape Town, Izzy falls in with a motley crew of street children, so-called colored boys. And the interaction is so poignant. They teach him their language. They show him how to fish. They really draw him in. And it's rich in details and textures. It's very evocative of the time. Tell us more about this crew of street children.
Well, yeah. The colored kids, the Cape Coloreds, as they're well known as, they occupied a different, difficult and often invisible place in society. Many lived at the edges of the harbor, the markets, railway stations, alleyways, poorer districts near the docks. The city was already sharply divided by race, class, and colonial power, because the British were there, and children without families or protection were especially vulnerable. As most of us know, the term Cape Coloured referred to a diverse mixed heritage community shaped over centuries by the blending of African, Khoisan, Malay, slave, European, and other ancestries unique to the Cape. So for boys, these boys living on the streets, survival often depended on improvisation. They ran errands to the docks, polished boots, carried parcels, scavenged, begged, slept in groups for protection, or found occasional work in kitchens, stables, or wherever. Some attached themselves loosely to gangs of older boys or to sympathetic adults. Others drifted around. At the turn of the century, in Cape Town, the contradictions that these boys were often hardened by necessity and yet still unmistakably were children.
Yeah,
and they've developed sharp instincts, humor, quickness, toughness beyond the years, but beneath that was profound insecurity. And I can go on, there was also an extraordinary humanity within these communities. Many Cape Coloured neighborhoods were rich in music, food, religious life, and mutual care. When I wrote the book, I was digging into all of this. I was unearthing all this stuff that I thought I knew, but there was so much more to it. The hungry child might still be fed by strangers. But for many of these boys, the deepest wound was not simply poverty, but the feeling of being discarded,
yeah,
of believing that they had been forgotten by the world.
And Izzy must have felt that. He must have felt that acutely. And even more so because he does befriend these, and these boys really become his brothers in many ways. I mean, it's much more than a friendship. But he was still foreign. He was white.
Yeah.
He didn't know the language. He had to learn the language. He didn't know the culture. So, I mean, there's a very moving scene of him tasting curry for the first time. This very weird, you know, you think of this child growing up in Vilna with a chont and a cabbage maybe they would eat, or potatoes. And then this exotic explosion of curry on his mouth. And I would imagine that took time to get used to.
Yeah.
He also has a black man who really looks after him in many ways and kind of brings him, looks after him and looks after the boys. And they remain friends, it seems, throughout their lives. Was there a real person in Izzy's life that did that?
He had a few friends, and they were not only the Cape Coloured kids, but they were Khoisa, Zulu. He could speak all the languages quite well. And because he went down the mines, he could speak Funigalo,
right,
I guess, in those days. So he was always with these people. When they discovered some diamonds and they all went out to celebrate, they all bought themselves suits and went out to the expensive restaurants they couldn't afford before. And he was questioned, and there was a whole racial issue of the white people around saying, why are you sharing this with your black friends? And why do you talk like a Cape Coloured?
Yeah, I'm sure.
And that's how he did. He learned to talk as a from the Cape Coloureds. So that is really interesting and something he had to do to survive.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah, you do what you have to. And incredible resilience for an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old. I mean, I can't actually imagine it. But we'll talk more about Kimberley later. But surviving the streets of Cape Town, or actually any of the stories, the whole book, it starts in Vilna. We touch on the Cape. We go to Kimberley. We go to Johannesburg. And I know you did a lot of research. You have spent hours and hours in the archive. And after this interview, you are heading back to the archives. Have you loved it?
Yes. We try to find the one ad that is in the newspaper. We haven't found it yet. And I've been sifting through the archives. I've done about 7 years of reading almost every Cape Times and every Cape Argus newspaper to try and find this elusive ad that is running the paper, because that's how he found his parents again.
His parents, really driven by his mother, but when they got to South Africa, they started publishing these ads, hoping that somebody would know something about this little boy, Izzy Lieberman. And that's eventually how he does reconnect with his family. But wow, if we could find that ad, that would be gold. I would love to see that. You've spent a lot of time researching, and there are things in the archives, but then there's a whole lot of context, of textures, of colors, of details that you had to find somehow in a different way, or you had to create it and create the fiction around it. How did you get those details right? Was it difficult?
It was, but there was discoveries all the time between actually reading through the newspapers in the archives. I found amazing stuff, and I didn't even know how newspapers were actually made in those days. That's a whole lovely story I have to tell you. But there was never a headline on the front page. The front page was garlics advertising their wares.
Really?
The second page was maybe more of that and homes for lets and stuff. By about the fifth page, you'd actually get the real news of the day. On the fifth, and there had been tiny little articles of them. And by the way, reading all that and seeing all the trouble there was in the world in 1899, I'm not surprised that there's, everyone says the world has gone crazy. Well, you should read some 1899 newspapers and see how many trains crashed, ships sank, and what everyone went through. And this is all happening around him. And I wanted to put way more in that, but it sort of took away from his story. So I tried to put in bits and pieces of that and explain it to the audience that way.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think we always assume that we're living in the worst of times and that things have fallen apart. But actually, each generation had their pickle, had their challenges. Just a lovely story on working on the language on this book, because we had to get it absolutely right. The Yiddish had to be right. The language that the street boys spoke had to be right. And so we used experts in both fields. In fact, Hilton Kaplan, who hosts the Yiddish show on Chai FM, helped us with the Yiddish and helped us get the right context and the exact right words of how they would have been applied. And in terms of the street children, we employed a very different approach to get that language right, because we started off with Afrikaans text, which would not have spoken. Cape Coloureds living on the street now would not use a pure Afrikaans. They use a dialect called Afrikaaps, and it's very specific. So we used an editor in Stellenbosch who does work with an NGO of street children, and she sat with them and got translations of every single sentence. So it really smacks of authenticity, and this is how you get the feel for the story, or what Izzy at least would have experienced. 11 years into his disappearance, the once abandoned boy arrives in Johannesburg. He's seen the advert. He's going to reunite with his family. But he is scarred. He's scarred by hardship. He's hardened by survival. And he comes face to face with this family that he has lost forever. And the reunion is so moving and so heartbreaking, because he's a very different person, Izzy, to his family. And the rest of the family are overjoyed. at having him back. Takes a bit of getting used to. But his father, Abraham, never really accepts that this really was his son, Izzy. Why do you think he never accepts him?
Well, that is the good and interesting question. So he was sort of a much, let's say, weaker kind of person. His wife used to always run things for him. He was a tailor. He didn't work that hard. He just worked at his little, what he did at his sewing machine. And when the boy disappeared, he obviously was so shocked. He searched for him for a while, for a week or two, and had to go up to Johannesburg because there was a big infections happening in Cape area, and everyone had to get out. When he must, he thought the boy was dead. And when the boy comes back at 19 years old, speaking English, Afrikaans, different languages, a bit of Khoza, Zulu, he said, "This is not my, how could this be my son?"
Yeah.
But we don't know the actual truth behind all of that and what happened. But we do know that it was bad enough that he didn't accept him because in the next book, my grandfather never gave his father a stone on his grave. He refused to let anyone put a stone on Abraham Lieberman's grave at Brixton, Cemetery. And I've been there, I've seen it without the stone, it is there forever. There's much more to that story, but we know
you've
that...
You've got to read the book.
Yeah, it is that bad that the stone was never put on the grave.
But you've mentioned before, and of course, my heart is always with Izzy, so I can't quite believe that his father never accepted him. But I think there was a whole lot of guilt, you know, that maybe he didn't try hard enough. But to be fair, there were many people who knocked on their door once that ad went out, right, saying they were Izzy, right?
Many imposters came to the door. I'm your son, feed me. There were a lot of poor people around. Mm. And knocking on the door, they had a lot of people, and he, being weak-willed, couldn't deal with all the stuff. His wife dealt with them and shooed them away and got rid of them. But when Izzy actually eventually came, even with a picture of himself in his pocket, it is hard for him to believe it. And it maybe he did sort of come to terms with it later, but Izzy wasn't happy that he didn't open his arms to him.
Yeah, quite heartbreaking, actually. But human. I think that's a very human response on both their parts. And just sad that they never reconciled at the end. But perhaps there was a different kind of reconciliation for Izzy, because his story started, it was so difficult for him. But he doesn't just survive. He thrives, and he builds a beautiful family, and he builds businesses, and he makes money, and he's able to give to poor people and look after other families. He really becomes an incredible human being, actually, a larger-than-life human being. Did this indomitable spirit inspire you?
Of course. And, well, he eventually had 8 children, and one of them was my father, Robert. And my father told me all these stories, and my father took after him. When Izzy actually died, he left everything to my father, because my father promised him he would look after the whole family, take care of everyone, and that's what he did. Mm. His whole life was devoted to making sure the family survived with whatever they needed. He invested for them. He did everything for them.
Incredible, incredible human being. The story is so inspiring. And it's much more than a biography. It's much more than one man's personal tale. It's a kind of tribute to the resilience of the human spirit. I strongly encourage you to read it. We've had, Eric has had such fulsome praise for the book. Somebody, Christopher Beaumont, said, "By the end, you will feel like you've lived several lives. What a journey." The book is available at Exclusive Books, at Takealot, in all different formats. You can also download it on either your Kindle or other devices. And if you'd like, you can listen to the audio. Eric, thank you for joining us. It has been a delight to talk to you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you,
and Batya. We look forward to the next book and the next visit to our studio.
Great. I'll be here.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and we've been talking biography, autobiography, and memoir, real stories about real people. To end the show, I'd like to pay tribute to a luminous life, to Edith Eger. She was a woman who walked through unimaginable darkness and chose again and again not just to survive, but to live with grace, courage, and a fierce commitment to healing. Her story is not only one of endurance, but of transformation, a reminder that even in the face of profound suffering, the human spirit can find a way to rise, to forgive, and to become a light to others. Dr. Edith Eger was a trauma psychologist, so she used a lot of what she learned in the work that she did. But it took her to age 90 before she wrote and published her story, her best-selling memoir, The Choice, Embrace the Impossible. It was released in 2017 and it sold over 1 million copies. It was also followed by The Gift. And it was a story of, she was sharing her silence about her trauma, and the story of healing and choice. And the world was certainly the richer for having her story. If you can imagine, she tells the story. She was a gymnast. She was a dancer. And of course, the war upended all her plans. But Joseph Mengele, the evil Joseph Mengele SS officer, heard that she was a dancer. So picture this. It's 1944. And she's the 16-year-old ballerina and gymnast. And she is sent, Edith Eger is sent to Auschwitz. And she is asked to dance for Joseph Mengele. And she thinks to herself, dance at a time and place like this, it seems absolutely impossible. And then I just want to read you something I wrote. It's a book that I wrote called Goodnight Golda, about brave and mighty Jewish women who inspire us all. And Edith Eger was one of them. And this is how she speaks about that dance that she did for Mengele. She closes her eyes. The familiar strains of music fill her ears. Her limbs feel heavy from terror, but the Blue Danube is a dance she can do in her step. In her sleep, she blocks the scary thoughts racing through her mind. The barracks floor becomes the stage in the Budapest Opera House. Her drab prison garb transforms into a sparkly tutu, and she imagines flowers being thrown at her feet. The hushed audience. She dances and twirls, a high kick, which she was famous for, and a pirouette. She remembers her mother's advice. No one can take from you what you have put in your mind. She was certainly an inspiration to many people, and I think an inspiration to other survivors to share their story. And this is how she reflects on her journey. She says, as a psychologist, a mother, a grandmother, and great-grandmother, an observer of my own and others' behavior, and as an Auschwitz survivor, I'm here to tell you that the worst prison is not the one the Nazis put me in. The worst prison is the one I built for myself. We're going to miss Edith Eger. When the camp is finally liberated, she is pulled from a pile of bodies, assumed dead, but she was alive. And the Holocaust didn't break her. In fact, it helped her to live again with this life-affirming strength and remarkable resistance. The Choice is her unforgettable story. You have to have this on your shelf to read and reread on a regular basis. May her memory be for blessing. And something caught my eye. It is not strictly a memoir, but it is an incredible book by a woman called Gila Fine, who's an exceptional teacher and student. Gila Fine is a National Book Award winner, Jewish Book Award winner. She's a Rabbi Sacks Book Prize and Maimonides Award for Excellence winner. Her speciality is Talmudic philosophy, and she's written a book called The Mad Woman in the Rabbi's Attic. It's a book that I read twice. I literally finished and started again. It's exceptional. What she does is she takes Talmudic stories about woman, and she filters it through the lens of a 21st century woman, looking at the different archetypes of how women were presented in the Talmud. And obviously, the Talmud was written at a certain time and is a product of its time and place. But what she does is she recognizes with her literary eye how there are 6 to 8 different Jewish woman archetypes that are explored in the Talmud actually in a very sophisticated way. She unpacks these Talmudic stories, finding layers that you never thought you would ever see. You can get to hear and learn with Gila Fine. She is exceptional. The Midrasha in Cape Town is running a course. It's an online course, so you can join from wherever you are. It's a global learning series, and it's online on Tuesday evenings, starting this Tuesday. For more information, go on to meltincapetown.org, www.meltincapetown.org, and I strongly suggest that you sign up. You will love the time with her. I hope you have enjoyed these real life stories, stories really reminding us of how extraordinary ordinary lives can be. Next week, I'll be at the Franschhoek Literary Festival, which is marvelous. It's the Rolls Royce of book festivals in South Africa. So the show next week will give you a taste of the delights on offer at FLF. And we'll be chatting to Paige Nick, author, interlocutor, festival organizer, curator, and chief of the hugely popular Good Book Appreciation Society, and a radio book show host too. We're going to be talking about books and her life in books. So you will see me next week. It's recorded, but it will be as entertaining. And I'll be with you thereafter live and in person the following week. Goodbye and happy reading.